Good afternoon. Thank you, everybody, for being here for this session. Today, I'm not sure. I mean, the title of this session is quite ambitious: New Network Geographies. It's so ambitious that I think, personally, that overarches the whole Transmediale conference, if you think about it. There's one interesting thing in this title. In fact, a lot of interesting things behind this phrasing, but there's a couple of ideas that I think that keep resounding in this edition of Transmediale, and they both are related to networks and geographies. New network geographies has a double meaning, if you will, because on the one side we're talking about geographies, and geographies, meaning the surface of the planet we live in, are more and more connected and networked, actually. The whole Transmediale this year has been delving into this, you know, how we understand the planet in this way, how we inhabit the planet, how we are changing the planet for good or worse. And this is very much related to the way we adopt different types of mediation, you know, to live in this planet. This is one meaning to me of this phrasing, new network geographies. But there's another meaning to it, which means probably that there's new geographies that are involved with the idea of networks. We are building new spaces. Probably space is not the right word, because we are used to talking about space in terms of our bodies, how they can actually walk through a space or move or breathe into a space. Probably these new spaces are different. Probably a space that our bodies do not understand very well. Probably a space that are, they exist in electrons, in cables, in data centers, on screens, on devices. So we have to do a lot of work to define these things, these spaces, these new possibilities, which are extraterritorial. Sometimes they're even extra bodily, to say, in some way. So that these two, you know, issues, these two poles, geographies through networks and new geographies, new spaces. Now, if you actually attended sessions, conferences, keynotes, workshops at this year Transmediale, you will probably have seen a lot of these. The work done around these topics. What we are going to do today, this afternoon, is actually understanding these very complicated matters through the practical work of artists, designers that actually defy the very same categories of what's art and what's design. So a practical approach to this, which is very much rooted in research and in taking action, in a way. Taking action and inhabit, basically, these new geographies from different points of view. You will see that our speakers this afternoon, Yasmin Fischer and Rasmus Svensson. Rasmus is 50% of Power, PWR Studio. Anna Nilsson is now here today, unfortunately. They will have a different approach to these things, a different creative approach, even. But there's an interesting thing about them, that they also collaborated on some projects. So I think that it's a very interesting scenario here. Practice-based investigation and research, creative output, very experimental in a way, and different approaches, different ways of dealing with this thing. So I leave the mic to them. And of course, as usual, after some short presentation, we will have enough time for a conversation with you. Questions, comments, etc. Okay? Thank you very much for coming again, and the mic is for you.
Thanks, Bonnie. Yeah, so my name is Rasmus. I'm, as Bonnie said, half of Power Studio, and the other half, Hanna, is unfortunately sick, so couldn't be here. So, Power Studio, we work aesthetically and technically sort of taking up the professional role as of the designer. And I would say to put it very broadly, maybe in a vague way, we work sort of, we're interested sort of in the how individuals interact and form groups and sort of live together, mediated by technology. So we're kind of focused on interfaces like screens and sort of at this sort of intersection points. And we were asked to work on the on a platform for connected to this exhibition, also connected to a series of exhibitions that will happen through the year, including the influencers in Barcelona, based sort of around the format of the Freeport. So some sort of, in a way, like extraterritorial place or like a non-place or repository for stuff, or in this case, information, so digital stuff. And one aspect of it was to try to work with alternative ways of distributing and alternative ways of sort of alternative internets or alternative webs. And we decided to work with something called IPFS, which is a peer-to-peer file system that we have been interested in for quite some time. Because maybe I should say when we talk about geographies, like in a way we're sort of more interested in maybe like sort of the geometries or topographies or something like that of networks, or the sort of data structures. So we worked on, like, if you like here to the right upper corner, there's sort of the thing that you see, like if you the sort of the gateway or the front end, and then there's sort of like a layer that works as a gateway between like sort of the old internet, the old web, and sort of what could potentially be a new web. And without getting into like the technicalities of it, what we find interesting with this, to take another sort of geometrical, a diagrammatical view of it, is IPFS as a sort of way of packaging data works in the way that you have a piece of data and you get like sort of and you enter this into like a sort of a machine or a function, and then you get out like almost like a magical number, like a what is called a hash of this data. And this to me is like sort of the thing I find most interesting, because you almost get into like some sort of like Borges Library of Babel thing, where like each piece of information has its own code. We're working quite a bit with this couple of years back, trying to work on something, sort of a permanent publishing platform where you would be able to publish text and then have it have it be verifiable through this hash. And it didn't actually go that far, but this is sort of an idea that we can come back to. And it's been kind of interesting to see over the last year, sort of in the talking about or thinking about like the truth or like verifiable information, because there's been of course a lot of talk about fake news and things sort of the possibility of actually of knowing like the world in a way, but this technological solution doesn't really it's only able to verify content in an extremely literal way. So like for example here you have two different phrases I mean, or the same phrase, but like written in two slightly different ways, and they result in completely different codes. So it's really like, it doesn't really like solve the problem of meaning. This is something this is a project that actually Hanna is working on together with a Finnish artist called Jenna Sutila. It's a bit related because they are developing a technique for extracting sort of the essence of a human being into a sort of compressed form, so like the physical essence of a human being. So I will not talk too much about it because I don't really know too much about it. Unfortunately, Hanna is not here, but yeah. So trying to follow this thread a bit further, here's a video, or stills from a video that we're currently working on, called Pandemonium. And it's trying to show a future where you could say that this sort of addressability of information has, or information has sort of merged with the physical reality. Because we're definitely like a lot more focused on like the digital aspects of things. But we also, I mean, in this case, envision a even closer intermeshing of like physical and digital. So we're trying to imagine some sort of interface, like a very physical interface that almost becomes some sort of, almost becomes some sort of divination or something like that. So like sort of interacting with material that somehow is like interface to something else. And also trying to show it in a very physical way, although like the end result in our case is shown on a screen. So it's images, like flat images. And to actually get to the work that we and Jasmine have done together over the last year. So this is a project called Surf Club that was shown here on the opening, so maybe some of you saw it. And I think we have slightly, or maybe first to describe it like practically, it's a like a infinite film composed of live streams. So practically, this like it's a database of live streams. There's a database of sounds, and there's an algorithm for combining these into a stream, into a movie, in a way. And there's also like a text component to it. And I think we have kind of different, we probably have different ideas of exactly what it is, what the point is. But to me, what I'm interested in is sort of how to modulate sort of a transmission, or modulate a stream to have meaning in some sense. And sort of like trying to find some sort of that sort of area between, like sort of the edge between meaninglessness and meaninglessness, and sort of, in a way, like making something like a sort of minimum viable narrative, that you have something that, yeah, that does balance on that edge. And yeah, I mean, and that's, and of course, like I should also say, like this sort of maybe the fourth component, which is quite important, is of course the, or maybe the main component is sort of the viewer, who will, she will sort of create the actual meaning. I would say. Yeah. Oh, sorry. Yeah, I think I'm done, so maybe.
Who was here for the opening night, for the screening? Have you actually saw the Surf Club video stream? How many? Can you raise your hand just to have an idea? Oh, just very few of them. Okay, so it's probably new to them.
Yeah, so I work as a research-based artist, and in my work, there's not a real translation of the research material to the material that forms the artwork. The material directly forms the artwork. So I would like to say something about... I'm not so used to these microphones. So I will say something about the material itself and not go like from a viewpoint, this project is about this, etc. So I would like to start by saying something about this map. This is a Ortelius map from 1570, and I reference this map in my work a lot. And so if you look at this map, you see that the world looks slightly different than our maps now look like. For instance, the supercontinent at the bottom of it is called Terra Australis, which basically swallows Antarctica and Australia. And it's sort of believed for about two centuries, actually, that this supercontinent existed. And it's sort of mirrored by the North Pole continent. And if you would zoom in to the middle of the North Pole there, you would see a little rock standing exactly in the middle, which would be a giant magnetic rock. And this would be the reason why the compasses show north. And so thinking about this map, maybe there's a lot different, but there's also a lot the same in a way. Like all the continents are about in the right place. And then you think of the maps that we use now, and they're basically transformations of the Mercator map, right? So in a way, it's not that different. And also, no map is accurate, right? It's impossible to make a sphere into a flat surface. I mean, try peeling a mandarin and flattening it down. You will always keep this curve on it. And at the same time, every map is political, which always makes me think about this image. And so, the maker of the map also sort of decides what the center of the map is, right? So the map is a sphere, you can decide what the center is, and in a way he pulls himself sort of away and sort of stands together with the gods and looks over the world. And so this makes me always think about what is a center and what is a periphery, which is very important for me. And this also makes me think that a simple shift in what is the center of the world already gives you a way different vision about the world. And this is something I did in the book I recently published, which is also available here at the bookshop. So it's called Conflict Atlas, Geopolitics and Contingency on the Malvinas Falklands Archipelago. And it's sort of centered around the Falklands War. To be sure, who has heard about the Falklands War? That's quite a lot. Quite good, you guys. Yeah, so for the ones that don't know, the Falkland War was between the United Kingdom and Argentina in 1982. It lasted for about 2 months. About 1,000 people died, of which 700 Argentinian soldiers, 300 British soldiers, and 4 Falkland Islanders. And here you see a satellite shot of the Falkland Islands. So they are about sort of half the size of Belgium, I would say. And this is the very cheerful landscape of the Falkland Islands. So there's basically no natural tree growth. If you are there, the gusts of wind pierce through you. Darwin did some research there, and he got utterly depressed every time and called it the worst place in the world. And you still have these sort of shattered sort of wreckage from 1982 still there. And I always feel that, thank you very much, that the people sort of have these records there as a sort of proud scars of the world, of the war, right? They survived in a way. And so lots of people, when they think about the Falklands War, they think of Thatcher and the big task force and loud music and red screens. And it's sort of a almost like a boy dream, right? The kids who were like 10 at that time had posters of Falklands War in their room. But what I found more interesting, just taking a step back, is that every event leading to the Falklands conflict was actually connected to some bigger geopolitical conflict somewhere in the world. So what I decided to do is create a book about the history of war as seen through the eyes of the Falkland Islands. And I'm going to give a little example of that. So for instance, this is a minefield that is presently there. The war left about 25,000 landmines, of which 20 anti-personnel mines and 5,000 anti-vehicle mines. And since 2009, these landmines are dug out by Zimbabwean deminers. And deminer is actually a word. And so they come with groups of about 50. And I traveled with them for a while. And as you can see, clearing a landmine on the Falkland Islands is not really a very high-tech thing to do. So these little red sticks you see there, they signify a landmine. Then they build a trench around it, and then they basically lay down in the trench, which you can see is like peat soil here, and have a very sophisticated stick, and then poke until they find the landmine, and then sort of put it at the daily harvest site here, which is a spectacular firework every day. And I find this story about the Zimbabweans quite strange because, as many of you know, Zimbabwe used to be a colony of the United Kingdom called Rhodesia. Cecil Rhodes, the colonizer of Zimbabwe, actually believed that United Kingdom was the summum of civilization, right? And he felt that everybody who was part of this, who could be a colony of this great United Kingdom, had won a lot from the lottery. And so he was very surprised that when he colonized what he called Rhodesia, actually there was a lot of uprising. And the woman that you see here in the middle is called Nehanda, and she's a very important figure of the uprising against Cecil Rhodes. Regretfully, they did not win against Cecil Rhodes, but this man who you all know, Mugabe, he did. He was recently taken out of power after 37 years. And because of the big fight against the United Kingdom, which lasted for a couple of centuries, still about 20,000 landmines in Zimbabwe remain. And because of this, there's a lot of landmine clearing expertise in Zimbabwe. At the same time, because the reign of Mugabe was considered a dictatorship, so there's no international money going in clearing the landmines on the Falkland Islands. And so this is why these Zimbabweans, they travel over the whole world on sort of commercial commissions. They travel to, this is a picture from Afghanistan, this is a picture from Congo, and here they are on the Falkland Islands, and they don't see that position as quite ambiguous, and actually two Zimbabweans stayed, one is a waiter and the other one is a carpenter now, and they got their whole families over. And so in the Conflict Atlas, I sort of follow the story of the Zimbabwean war through the eyes of the Zimbabwean deminers. So this is a sketch of Falkland Islands again. As you can see, there was no natural tree growth, right? But there are 5 penguin species, and there's 11 kinds of landmines on the Falkland Islands. And an anti-personnel mine, on average, detonates at the weight of about 20 kilos, and a penguin weighs about the weight of 5 kilos, depending on the species. And this is why the penguins are able to walk over the landmines. And in 35 years, it actually sort of created this landmine penguin reservations, which used to be very sort of popular beaches for the local population. This is a time zone map. So speaking of the United Kingdom, to me it's always very strange that the United Kingdom is time zone zero, right? And everything is either minus United Kingdom or plus United Kingdom. And also the introduction of the time zones end of 19th century sort of is sometimes said to have given an awareness of that we are actually one world together. So before we used to have time zones per city and you would live in that sort of little civilization, but actually the creation of the time zone gave you the awareness of sort of the world, but also the state of the world, and also created this first feeling of what Germans called Weltschmerz. I will say a little bit about a second project that is just in the making right now, which is called Your Touch So Foreign. So this started as a sort of explanation about collective memory and authenticity and also cultural appropriation. So when we speak about cultural appropriation, we mostly speak about this, if this is okay, and if this is okay. And I again thought, okay, let's maybe take the Western conversation away and maybe shift a little bit to another place in order to get a new perspective. So I traveled to Kalmykia. And so for those who don't know, Kalmykia is a republic within the Russian Federation. People that live in Kalmykia are Mongol. They migrated in the 16th century, about 4,000 kilometers away. And they are Buddhist and have a nomadic lifestyle and have their own language. And so you might not know the Kalmyk, but you do know the Ewoks. So the Kalmyk stood as a model for the language of the Ewoks in Star Wars. So sound designer Baird Burt had a Kalmyk woman speaking in a microphone, and he based the language on them. And that is actually not the only thing that is quite spacey about the Kalmyk, which I very much enjoyed. So also very famous futurist Russian poet Velimir Khlebnikov was raised with the Kalmyk. And here you see a little sketch that he made about the perception of time. So he felt that the timeline did not represent the sort of relative way you experience time. And he was drafting all kinds of new constellations in which you can represent time. And he was in his work always very influenced by the Kalmyk. So there was this sort of true attempt to sort of eliminate all culture of the Kalmyk during the Soviet time. First, they weren't allowed to be nomads anymore. Then they took away the language, the clothes, etc. And then in 1943, for 14 years, the entire population was deported to Siberia. And when I was there, I had the privilege to speak to a lot of survivors about these deportations. And during my trip, we made this sort of visual sketch, which takes about 5 minutes, which is basically all based on interviews with them. So we'll put the sound on now. So only in 1957 the Kalmyk were allowed to return again to their beloved steppes. And that was actually all that there was, right? There was only steppes. There were no houses, no temples, etc. And so they had the choice how to rebuild their own culture again. And only after the dissolution of the Soviet Union in the 1990s, they were actually allowed to speak their own language again and to practice Buddhism again. So by that time, they had two full generations that was sort of detached from their own culture. And at the same time, during the Soviet time, the Russians, they grew corn on the steppes, which is infamously hydrophilic. And this drew all the water out from the steppes. And right now, Kalmykia, in combination with global warming, is 80% suffering from the process of desertification. And all this sort of distance made me think about, so there's this distance from who they were as Mongols, who they were before the deportations, who they were before the dissolution of the Soviet Union. And so this made me think again about these Khlebnikov constellations of time and distance and how relative that could feel. So the Kalmyk had a choice how actually to reappropriate that culture, right? And so one important guy that was instrumental for them, that was Kirsan Ilyumzhinov. You see here, him here to the left playing a game of chess with Gaddafi. And Kirsan Ilyumzhinov did not only believe that he was abducted by aliens, but he also believed that and still believes that chess is a game that comes from space, and because everywhere in the world the rules are the same. So he decided to rebuild the public, the republic, based on chess. So everybody in the republic is now compulsory to be a chess player, and he built this sort of modern day suburbia based around this really big sort of chess arena where also a lot of chess Olympics are held, and he built this sort of little city around it, which looks very much like a little bit of like a Truman Show. And the city actually also has different praying points for different religions. So there's like a little Buddhist place, a little Christian place, there's even a little Islamic place. So it's very Truman Showy. And think about, this is the poorest republic in all of Russia, right? So this is a very strange gesture to make. And they also made this sort of chess sort of fashion, because the fashion is a big discussion in the authenticity question between the Kalmyk right now. So they're all the time discussing about, do you follow tradition from before the deportations to every little detail? This is a famous hat from before the deportations, or do you customize and go with globalization? And that's maybe like a nice note to end on, that there's a little clip here where you also can hear the famous Kalmyk Ewok language.
Halvi kilna bulgine kil martulgo bi evraterskin kilan medher bnf tadne de yungi chekelksin medifta
en yirin surur tadnege enuge orchultun gichkun sur jaxshi.
Бұл тәдінегі күн шо жақшы, тана үшіретіні күн сәрі өлхәр бәқші, тәдінегі тәріскінші бешіт, геже күн басы кемшәғір бәқші.
Мадын шөйліңі тұскар кәлжен әведін. Гегәрілті үркчен, сұг дәлкен, сұг ұлсын дейілді, зұг тәрі олына қайсын дұтыр, әуірі ұлсан кейхір бәнті.
Амырын қайға торыс келер, онсы келер, дұғарат, әуірі келер ғайлқын бі?
Әлі, юмы сойылғы, тір кеверін өлдәқін бі? Хосын, ғырарын сәвәт, нанды керуго биті егет бәнәв гиғәт.
Келәсі, сойыласы екілет, яғджы мана халым ғылсын ұқа, сеген, заң, бәртсі, гейдірәт кезе ұлға болғын күләхін бе, ән цук тана бейінттің шүйілігі бол жана.
Тадында үйінін сән кежі, тадын өрән метхі зөфтәд.
Тана ұқан әнөгі нек талын ғархын, тадын метхі зөфтәд. Биясын ағын әкелтін. Кехі күн арған хәдік, кешко күн чинриярын хадык.
Альда Йовувчыгын келян мартылуго, дотран хадыглат йохы керкте. Хоурындан бичкдайд харкларын зөйрі тұрскын келерін күйіндет бәйхлі мана келін бұйсышко.
Yes, so maybe to end with a map as well on the connection to surf club as well is for me looking at all these maps in my work always and thinking about this. So this is of course the backbone map, right? The cables of the internet that are through the ocean. For me, this map has a incredible potential because not only thinking about the tangible cables, but thinking that the internet sort of can put you in touch with a place and completely foregoing the map. And this is what I really enjoy about this live stream as well, because with the map, you are always dependent on who created it. And then regarding that, it's thinking about, am I in that center or not? And what does that say about me? And actually, in the process of working on Surf Club, it was very interesting to have this sort of direct connection to a place in the world and feeling this sort of relative space instead of this sort of power tool. And so maybe we can put Surf Club on the backdrop now.
What you're seeing here is Surf Club, and these are just a few minutes of it. Can we talk over these images? So what's Surf Club, practically speaking? Is it just like a flow of images that are flowing through the internet?
Yeah, exactly. It's a database of live streams that is put together by a sort of an algorithmic director.
They're all live, they're live streams.
Yeah.
Even though we are seeing a non-live version, or is it live as well?
It's live right now.
It's live right now.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe it's interesting to say also something about the subtitles that are generated, right? Because they are sort of created at random.
Yeah, I mean, there's as I mentioned earlier, for me, maybe the most interesting thing is sort of you have these components that are random,
yeah.
Right? Like the live streams, and they are curated, selected, but they're still somehow kind of raw input, raw reality in some sense. And there's the sound, and there's text, and they're all kind of random. But there's also a algorithmic sort of diagrammatic engine trying to combine this into some sort of meaning.
Yes.
And there's also the human desire to find meanings or patterns within data.
Yeah, even I sometimes when watching it am thinking, what is the meaning? Well, I know the way it is, we have constructed it, so to say.
Who put the cameras and why? That's interesting, you know? You can see a store. This morning there was a swimming pool. You can see streets. Sometimes it's just black. Or blank.
Yeah, then it's night somewhere.
Yeah. And things happen, actually.
Yeah, I mean, there's also in a way, having the expectation that something will happen. You sort of, if you see a, if there's a,
I don't know, if there's a rifle on the hung on the wall, you expect it to be fired at some point. And if you see a door, you expect somebody to enter through the door. And it's also like, I mean, to me at least, I think of these footage, like sort of footages of spectacular, or like spectacular or horrifying things happening, as you often see on like Facebook and so on. And there's like a normal situation that sort of gets out of hand.
Yeah, I remember when we were starting to talk about it. Actually, all these bombings were taking place, right, in Brussels airport and in Istanbul, and you had all these like live stream segments. Also, when in Munich this shooting was happening, there was this live stream on Facebook with the guy, like somebody literally screaming at the terrorist, and so this live stream gives sort of sometimes this feeling, because we know it like this, that something is going to happen.
Yeah, and I mean, there's also something with it. Somehow is easier to sort of have, like, to generate a mood of like a menacing mood. Like in general, that seems to be, at least like seeing this as some sort of like amateurish psychological experiments. Like on me, like I find it easier to sort of interpret things in a like sort of a menacing way, to sort of in a way like almost like a conspiratorial way, that you see these things that I sort of know how the engine operates, but I still sort of find it quite easy to imagine like a menacing scenario.
Yeah,
that's interesting, because it's a very human perspective, waiting for something to happen, no? Waiting for a narrative. It's not a movie. It's a set of machines and protocols working all the time. And from the machine point of view, there's a lot of things happening all the time. It's just data going on. Everything is just a new event, right? Yeah. It's just the humans that we are searching for some relevance, some value here. And I felt pretty much upset when I couldn't find any value in this. And that's a very strange situation. But then all of a sudden, things like this happen.
Yeah, I mean, I... like, listening now to what you were saying, like, in your presentation, I somehow, I mean... There's something about sort of the way that algorithms operate is in a, like a very like, I mean by definition like sort of a strict geometrical way, like do this, then do that, and do this. And of course, there's also like other more like ways that are supposedly more like intuitive, you could say. But there's like sort of this algorithmic creation of meaning, which I mean, is something that we all, of course, take part in, like in a much more like everyday and a much larger way. Like I mean, like on timelines and like feeds and so on, we sort of find this thing after this thing, combined with this thing, and then of course we sort of put it together into some sort of narrative of what is happening in the world or what is happening in our lives. And I mean, we know, I think, that there is no like big, I mean, we hopefully all know that there is no like super intelligent thing, like sort of combining these things, yet at least. We know that there's sort of like kind of like stupid systems, but we still sort of ascribe a lot of meaning to like the order of things, or like how things are combined. So this, I mean, to me, this what we are working on, which is very much like a work in progress, is like some sort of kind of naive experiment of generating meaning in some sense in this way.
Yeah, I find it also, just as an abstract thing, really beautiful, like you said, right? How frustrated you are when something doesn't have meaning, and that's something really essential in everybody's daily life, right? Something bad happens, which is not your fault, and you get so frustrated with the fact that something random just happens. And this tension in surf club, for me, becomes a bit poetic because of that.
Well, you're actually watching machines doing things and connecting to a big network of things that you don't have an idea. This is a way of telling that story maybe as well. Yeah. But there's one thing that actually surprises me, because this is like a history about what humans understand as void. Nothing is happening. And again, it can be interesting for all the things, the reasons we've been talking about so far. But at the same time, I make a comparison to the other projects of yours, which are very much focused on something that relates quite materially with human conflict, with stories, and especially unexpected stories that through some kind of material layer in the existence of humans, of human beings, connect historical facts. So it's right the opposite of void. Even the smallest thing, the Zimbabwean miners on the Falkland Islands, actually there is a very strong reason why, and everything is interconnected. So just the opposite of void is an excess of meaning that it becomes unperceived.
I don't know, I sometimes think you can just put whatever structure you want on the world and understand it that way, and it will be true. So you can understand the world from void, and you can understand the world from structure, and they both are right in a way. But what's something that comes back is this sort of what in German is called Kontingenz. What is that in English? The contingency. This sort of, I like that when things happen. Yeah, of course, the Zimbabweans, that is not random, right? But this chess is a bit random, and the Ewoks is a bit random, I always really hate when people sort of say, this is how it is in a way, right? And I feel there's always more sort of random, haphazard sort of things happening through different layers, through different complexities that build this sort of spectacle. It's never this one story. So I always hate it, therefore, that people say, yeah, it is like that, because you can... The most simple thing is not like that, in a way. So this is something, for me, that comes back in the projects and in Surf Club at the same time.
Do you have any question about, even practical questions, about how was that done, or there are microphones, I guess, over there and there? Any type of question, just we are talking. It's interesting because Rasmus and Yasmin have different backgrounds. According to usual definition or categories, Rasmus is more of a designer and Yasmin is more of an artist. But again, it's very fascinating how these territories are also shifting in a way. And there's so many things designers can learn from artists, and vice versa. And that's, I think, as also a professor in design schools, it's something that I can see every day. And I use art methodologies to do design research in a way, and even to explain theories. I use art examples without even telling they are art. And that's probably something that's worth experimenting here. We need new ways to tell what's going on, or write history in the case of the Falklands or the Kalmyk country. We badly need new ways of telling relevant knowledge and reproducing it, right? Do you think that your backgrounds helped this collaboration, or maybe posed some obstacles to it?
I mean, in a way, of course, when I talk about this, I usually, it's you have different professional roles, you play different professional roles and sort of fit into the system in particular ways. I mean, and that's just sort of a logistic aspect to it. I realize like every time that I speak to somebody, I mean, every time I speak to somebody, I realize that, I mean, for example, I'm extremely focused on screens, or like sort of flat representations of things, and like symbols and like sort of diagrams and like more like, which is, I mean, I have like a graphic design background, so that's sort of like the way I see things. Even if I, when I do like videos and stuff, I sort of see it as the end result as like sort of a flat thing. And I realized that definitely when every time I have to like deal with like three-dimensional situations, I mean, in a more professional manner, I realized that it's, and definitely like just, I mean, for example, I mean, your work, you're much, or I get the impression that it's much more specific in like dealing with particular, like a particular place, a particular, whereas I'm sort of, yeah, I think also in our collaboration, I think that I, for example, I mean, you worked a lot on with the streams, yeah. Like finding the streams. So you have a more like understanding of where they are coming from. And to me, they're sort of like just this thing, like I don't know where they are from. Yeah, so yeah. I mean, I'm pretty sure we see it differently in that way. But yeah.
Yeah, yeah, I think so too. But also I found, even though you, of course, you have like more digital mind in a way, and I have more like an earth mind. But I also found like a lot of our references still also were the same. Like we spoke a lot about literature and sort of other references. So I found it a very interesting balance in a way that speaking on, in a way, is the same level with completely different references and it made a sort of a new space between us in a way, literally. I think there's a question over there.
Oh, there's a question? Okay.
Hello. Hi. Thank you both for your presentations. Really, I really like this film you made together. But we are transmedial, so I also want to pose a critical note. My question is to Jasmijn. I'm also from the Netherlands, an artist or designer. But our work is, of course, only possible through the colonial history and, you know, the slavery and the way that wealth was produced over the backs of others. So this makes us able to go to these places, or places like Transmedia, but also the places you're going. So how do you address in your work, when you talk about people who have a different cultural context than your own and have different narratives, how do you address, I think, questions like coloniality, neo-coloniality, and Orientalism?
Yeah, that's something, of course, that you think constantly about. And you can never escape that. Even like the best way you try to treat that, there will always be from our heritage on, there will always be a little bit about that in there. But also, I was always sort of treading lightly, right? And then, for instance, in the comic case, their references are so different. For instance, because this whole history was erased, they have very strange resources to learn about themselves. For instance, take these human zoos that were held in Germany and London. They see that as a great opportunity for them because they were also displayed in these human zoos. And for them, that's one of the first moments that there was written about them and that there was footage about them. And so we were talking, of course, with people about the history and the archives, etc. So we all the time got this really proud, like, human zoos images, right? So. Yeah, there's something ambiguous about that as well. And what we also found, look, the people in Kalmykia right now are also Russian, and they are also on the internet, and they are also dealing with a trauma of the Second World War, like we are here as well, and my family is as well. So right now, with my peers in Kalmykia, we have more in common than culturally different, actually. So it was all the time this very interesting balance to take and how do you speak? For instance, in the film sketches, there was this very deliberate choice of not saying anything ourselves. So all the text was everything that the comic said to us. So we did not want to put a filter on it by re-narrating their story in a way. So it's a constant battle between choices and trying to be responsible, but also knowing that a little bit of that will always be in there.
Any more questions? Actually, in the screens that are on the other side of this room, you can navigate, surf through the works in these exhibitions, and that's the interface that actually Power designed based on the protocol IPFS that actually was mentioning about. And it's a little experiment to imagine practically what the future of one of the possible futures of this territory we keep calling the internet would look like, a distributed network in a way, with distributed contents that nobody will actually be able to take away and withdraw from a server because they will be already distributed. So it's not just an interface, and well, it's a beautiful one, but it's also a little statement about the need of other territories and infrastructures, probably, right? So if there's no further questions? Oh, yes, there's one. I'm sorry, you're in the dark.
Yeah, no, it's okay. Hi, I would first like to thank you for your lecture. And I would like to ask you, in your research, when you were researching Kalmyk people, I've noticed that they are trying to rebuild their nation and to rebuild their language. So have you found some other connection with some other people? Because or other republics, because I know that Irish people, they also forgot, well, only 20% of their people know Irish language, and they are trying to build from that some their national feeling, national language. So have you found some other examples, like Kalmyk people or Irish, how they are trying to rebuild their own their own culture all again? Thank you.
There's of course already in Russia there's a lot of these stories, right? Because the Kalmyk people were not the only ones that there was an attempt to sort of eliminate all culture. There's also a reason why there hardly are any rural accents in Russia right now, and this is also a global thing. I think in the choice of the Kalmyk, it was also about who can we tell the story that relates a lot to more universal topics. So it was not about doing some anthropologic or something, research like that, but more like who has a story that really resonates. And we really loved this whole science fiction aspect of the Kalmyk, and also this Klebnikov poet, and that's something elevated. And actually, if you are there, it has something really spacey as well, which is really great. So this is why you can, of course, choose any place you want to, but this is why I chose Kalmykia.
You just mentioned fiction. And that's interesting because there's no fiction in none of the projects we've seen today. But at the same time, they're all very much science fiction. Science fiction is not a very precise term, actually. What is science fiction? It's totally a wrong term if we were philosophers. But it's very useful because, you know, it relates to some of the things here. Basically, science fiction, how to say that, dissolves our sense of reality. In a way, you know, we let us open a door for the impossible to imagine. And the good science fiction is when it dissolves your reality, installs another reality, but this reality is related to the first reality, what we call the reality with a capital R. And I felt the same way going through your projects, in a way. They talk about something that are historical facts, but then you have this sense of the things that you were expecting are just like dissolving and blurring away, and you're open to rewrite and relearn history, probably.
Yeah, for me anyway, any narration around facts is fiction, so I never feel that I'm making a non-fiction work, in a way, so in both of the works.
Okay. So this time there's no further comment or question. Oh, they will be around. If you have some very specific question, you can actually approach them. Thank you very much for coming, and see you in the next of the conference of Transmediale.